Call the meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Economies Committee together. We'll start until we get a quorum. We'll start with Mr. Zelenka with the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. Welcome to the committee, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. I appreciate the invitation to be here today. I've been Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association for 29 years. A lot has changed over those 29 years in our industry, a lot of mergers and consolidations. Our industry, we represent country grain elevators and feed mills in the state of Minnesota. We have facilities in over 600 communities around the state of Minnesota. There's a lot of talk about ethanol plants and other kinds of ways to get employment out into rural areas. We have been and continue to be a major employer and a major taxpayer in most of these 600 communities around the state. We actually employ over 9,000 people statewide. Full-time, and another a chunk of folks on a part-time basis. So we're a significant player, kind of a quiet employer, if you will, I think, in rural Minnesota. Most of our elevators located where railroads stopped every 7 to 9 miles, kind of why you have a town every 7 to 9 miles and a grain elevator in the old days every 7 to 9 miles apart. That has changed a lot over recently with mergers and consolidations. For sure. I did pass out a packet of information that you may have in, well, you should have in your packet, the handout that you could reference if you like. Goes into some of the who our current directors are from around the state. We have a 9-member board. Representation on the board is from Freeport, Hanley Falls, Erskine, Northfield, Rothsay, Jackson, Sauk Rapids, Bellingham, and Mattawan, which is over by New Richland. Our industry, as I mentioned, has changed quite a bit over the last many years. As an example, in 1980, there were 275 local cooperative country elevators with 38 branch locations, 447 privately owned elevators, and 53 country facilities owned by regional cooperatives. Today, we're looking at 96 local cooperative country elevators with 139 branch locations, a little over 200 privately owned elevators around the state, which would be Cargill and is your mom and pop operations, 23 Twin City terminals locations, and 53 CHS owned and regionalized locations. So CHS has really grown in terms of their ownership and operation of country elevators around the state as well. I also attached a member survey to give you some information about our industry. It's a member profile. It goes into some of the basics of a sort of a country elevator or the average country elevator, if you will. And if you look at those numbers, the average country elevator employs 20 full-time employees, 6 part-time employees, handles over 7 million bushels of grain annually, does over $38 million in grain sales volume per year, and we also annually pay over $280,000 a year in combined payroll, property, and income tax. So certainly a major player in the economic vitality of rural Minnesota, and hopefully we'll continue to do that. Our oldest grain elevator, it's been in continuous operation, is the Co-op Country Farmers Elevator out of Renville, out of their Sacred Heart location, which has been in continuous operation since 1886. In fact, the average country elevator, the average cooperative country elevator, has been in business on average for 64 years. So it's a longstanding business, as I mentioned earlier, a major taxpayer, a major employer in most rural communities around the state of Minnesota. I also attached to the handout a list of the legislative priorities that we will be, recommending to our delegates. We have the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association has its annual meeting starting this evening, actually, so I appreciate being on the agenda first. I have to get to Duluth after this. We have our delegates voting on our legislative priorities on Friday. This is the recommendation coming from our Resolutions Committee to our delegates that will be discussed on Friday. And so, again, that's also in your packet or attached to the back of the packet that you have in your possession. Won't go through those. You can certainly look at those, and I'm sure we'll be talking about some of those as time goes on. Those are some of the areas of concern to our members, again, country elevators and feed mills around the state of Minnesota. Don't want to take a lot of your time. I know you have a busy agenda, but I guess suffice to say that we're an industry, a very quiet industry in rural Minnesota. Very involved in rural communities. Our members are the mayors, are the fire chiefs, are the school board members, and so forth and so on. And so the Country Elevator has been an integral part of rural Minnesota. Hopefully we will continue to be. It's been interesting. I've been doing this, like I mentioned, about 30 years. And when I first started, I was in the midst of the farm crisis in the early 80s. So it's I don't take it personally that I started at that point, and the industry seemed to go down at that point. But it was certainly a learning experience for us all. We had a major shakeout in our industry at that time. A lot of debt we were carrying at that time. Dealing with the banks, it was a challenge at that time. I know they're here in the building and the room here as well. But we've had our ups and downs. If you look at 87, the drought, the same year that the government got out of storing grain in our elevators, kind of a double whammy that year. Edge to arrive, floods, this, that. I mean, there's a lot of things. But anyway, long story short, we're still there. And we're dealing with a very volatile grain market today. A lot of strain on our available credit, making margin calls on our hedged positions, and it keeps guys pretty busy and very nervous at times. But long story short, it's been a good industry to be involved with, and appreciate the opportunity to be in front of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Zalecki. I'm
happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions from the committee? Well, I do want to commend you, you and your organization, Mr. Zelenka. You've certainly seen a gamut of changes in the past, and are likely to see more in the future. You know, I'm reading where the grain, especially corn, yields are expected to increase dramatically in the next several years. Somebody's going to have to handle that grain. And we appreciate the work you've done with us in the past, and extend our greetings to your members tonight.
Sure will. Thank you very much, Chairman.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Clerk will note the roll. We do have a quorum present now. Next on the list is the Cooperative Network. Well, welcome to the committee, Ms. Fredrigo. How's your day going today?
Well, except for the ice dams and the water damage in my basement.
Oh, no.
Thanks for asking, though.
I think, Minnesota's got a better climate.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name. You still are over there a little farther, aren't you?
Right. Right.
Okay.
And I believe I have some slides. Will those?
You do have some handouts here with us, and
I didn't know if. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want to take the time to do that now, or I can just talk from the slides, or?
Do you have the slides?
I do. I do have. Okay,
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, while my slides are getting pulled up, I can just do some quick introductions. Sure, thank you. Once again, my name is Amy Fredrigal, and I'm the Vice President of the Cooperative Network. Also, by way of introduction, just wanted to make sure that I mention our President and CEO is Bill Omakin, who many of you would know used to be a Deputy Commissioner over at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Our lobbyist, we are represented by Bruce Clavin, who most of you know, I'm sure. And also our Dairy Director is David Ward. And so I just wanted to mention some of those names for those of you that will be seeing those folks around the Capitol as well. Sorry. These slides are in front of you, so just wanted to give you a quick overview of the Cooperative Network. We are the trade association in Minnesota and Wisconsin that represents any business that's structured as a cooperative. Our name used to be the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives, and we changed that 2 years ago for those of you that knew us as MAC. So we represent any business in the agriculture community that's structured as a cooperative, also the farm credit institutions, credit unions, the rural electric cooperatives, housing co-ops. There's a lot of senior housing co-ops in rural areas, some healthcare co-ops, transportation, food co-ops, you name it. So we're a very diverse industry. So just kind of a quick overview, talking about what a cooperative is. We are businesses that are owned and controlled by members that actually use their goods and services. And so just kind of by way of contrast, an investor-owned corporation would be owned by outside shareholders that may or may not use their goods and services. So just kind of a point of distinction there. Around the world, actually, there are 7 co-op principles that all co-ops sort of adhere to and are part of. They're voluntary and open membership, democratic member control, member economic participation, autonomy and independence, education, training, and information, cooperation amongst cooperatives, and concern for community, which you hear talked about a lot these days. We feel that the cooperatives do have some difference from other corporate colleagues in that we do focus a lot on the long term instead of short-term financial horizons. Customer member owners want to ensure that they receive quality products and services, so their ownership interest is longer term. Cooperative boards are oftentimes more reflective of consumers rather than traditional stockholders. They are directed by their membership. That's what makes them eligible to run for their cooperative board of directors, and they also tend to be more consumer-oriented as well as having a large concern for their community, being that most are small, locally owned businesses. There have been some surveys done nationally that show that when compared businesses compared to non-co-op businesses on a number of indicators, quality, service, things like that, trustworthiness. Co-ops are rated higher by consumers than non-cooperative businesses, and we like to think that we really have earned that trust. We've also done some surveys in the upper Midwest here. A few years ago, actually, AgStar Financial Services had a survey done co-op members, actually anyone in Minnesota and Wisconsin. It was a representative sample, and it showed that people, generally speaking, knew that cooperatives were for the common good, and that if you had patronized a co-op or been a member of a co-op in the past, you were more likely to do that type of business again in the future because you'd had a good experience. The Rural Development Office of USDA here in Minnesota, our state office, a few years ago did a survey of all the co-ops in Minnesota, and we do have data that shows that Minnesota is the number one co-op state in the nation. There's over 1,000 cooperative businesses in every industry. About 3.4 million Minnesotans are members of just any type of co-op business you can think of, with $6 billion in gross sales annually, $18 billion in economic activity to the state, $146 million in state and local taxes, 80,000 jobs, and that co-ops are really an excellent source of economic development at the rural level. And a lot of that is because co-ops pass their profits off to their member owners in the form of patronage. So those patronage dollars, generally speaking, stay in the local level and revolve due to the multiplier effect, so they create more economic activity at the local level. And just drilling down a little bit deeper on some agriculture co-op data, this was also from the USDA Rural Development Report from a few years ago, and I could provide that study if anyone was interested in seeing that. But showed that at the time, a few years ago, the farm supply and grain co-ops in Minnesota had over $180 million in assets. There were several hundred ag co-ops. They were producing $17 billion in total economic impacts. And almost $650 million of that was actually attributed to the cooperative structure, which is the patronage that I mentioned, staying at the local level. Just some points of interest, 15% of soybean milling is generated by cooperatives, and 94% of the revenue in the dairy sector and 96% in sugar are generated by co-ops in Minnesota. So just to talk a little bit more specifically about our types of members at the local level that I'm sure many of you see all around in your districts. We represent the grain, farm supply, and fuel cooperatives that Bob mentioned in his comments as well. We work closely with a lot of those folks, several hundred farm supply, grain, and fuel cooperatives that can range from the Senex gas stations that you see to the local grain elevator. We also represent CHS and Land O'Lakes, CHS being the nation's largest cooperative. Also, some of the local co-ops that you might see are WFS or UFC, hundreds of jobs and giving back many hundreds of millions of dollars to their local communities in terms of patronage. We also work, as I mentioned, with the dairy cooperatives that more than 90% of the milk in Minnesota is marketed and processed through dairy cooperatives. So, for example, First District Association serves 1,000 dairies in 36 counties, employing 145 people and $500 million in sales. Also, AMPI has $1.4 billion in sales. And you'll be hearing a little bit from Mark Knisley from the United FCS. That's an example of our farm credit services that we represent. Farm credits are financial cooperatives. Minnesota's federally chartered farm credit co-ops serve Minnesota farm families and agribusinesses with $3.8 billion in loans. For example, AgriBank is the largest farm credit bank in the U.S. with more than $73 billion in total assets. AgStar serves 23 clients and $8 billion in loan and lease assets. So just to talk about a few of our legislative priorities for the year, our goal, because we represent so many agriculture and electric co-ops in Minnesota, is really to encourage rural development, agricultural development, and to increase competitiveness with other states. We also are really interested in bioenergy development, and there's a lot of entrepreneurial activity that goes on between agriculture and electric cooperatives and rural areas. So we're interested in the reforms that can help create a more business-friendly environment and do support the permit reforms being discussed, aiming at quicker turnaround times and more consistent and predictable processes. We also want to thank you for your past support of the Livestock Investment Grant Program. It's contributed to increased livestock production, local property values, and helped create hundreds of jobs. And so we do support a more reliable source of funding for that important program. And on a related note, the Livestock Investment Tax Credit, we also feel is an important program that can spur economic activity and support the ag community. And one thing that I think it's important to note is that under the Livestock Investment Tax Credit, producer has already created economic activity before the tax credit is issued. So just want to thank you for your support of those programs. We also do a lot of work with sort of youth development, career development, and opportunities for young folks in the agriculture community. And just wanted to let you know that we have some curriculum that we have produced recently about co-ops in Minnesota. We've worked in conjunction with the University of Minnesota, MEALC, the Minsky system on getting those resources out to co-ops, future co-op leaders and you know, maybe students in rural communities. So we appreciate your support of MEALC. And oh, my mic's. Oh, no, I'm sorry. So I've been blipping in and out this whole time. Every third word is sorry about that. We just wanted to say that we think a lot of important work is done at the University of Minnesota, and for that reason, we do support the Ag Special. And just kind of an update and also something to watch out for. Many of you have sort of followed our 40 Square Healthcare Co-op work over the last few years and want to thank you for the those legislative initiatives. We're currently working with the Department of Commerce on our regulatory application to provide a healthcare co-op for farmers, and look to the future for some updates from us that'll take shape in the form of some town hall meetings that should be in your local communities if you have farmers and their families that are interested in some healthcare options. So just kind of to wrap up, just to reiterate that co-ops create value for consumers and local communities and farmers with trusted brands, market productivity, and more opportunities in the marketplace, and employment and income for middle America. We're sort of an old idea that keeps taking new forms. There's lots entrepreneurial activity going on with cooperative businesses, and it's exciting for rural development. I just wanted to extend an invitation if there's ever anything that we can do with our local co-op managers or directors or staff that could be of any assistance to all of you. Please let us know how we can help create those partnerships. So I put an invitation to our Lobby Day, Co-op Day at the Capitol, in your packets, a little blue postcard here. It's March 3rd. We'd love to see you there, as well as at Dairy Day, which we co-host with Minnesota Milk, and that's on February 15th. So hope to see you there. And that's all I have for my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Questions, Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Chair Magnus. I have a question. When you, on the permitting reform slide, encourage bioenergy development, are you talking about biofuels or renewable electricity or both? Or?
There's just a lot of interesting ideas that are can work that local farm supply and grain cooperatives as well as electric cooperatives and even dairy cooperatives with anaerobic digesters, you know, whether it's switchgrass or some of our electric co-ops like Great River Energy have looked at partnering with agricultural cooperatives as well. So there's just kind of a lot of entrepreneurial activity going on altogether that the local cooperatives, because they already have the connections with the farmers, I think can be a partner in helping aggregate whatever the biomass might be. Or distribution, transportation, you name it. We have transportation cooperatives as well in our membership. So there's a lot of interesting relationships that are sort of already teed up and ready to go to help out with those business development ideas.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Federighel, does the cooperative have relationships with the Next Gen Board or the Roundtable? What is the connection with all these other outside, the LEC?
Mr. Chairman.
For input, for suggestions for research direction, where the U dollars should go. Just where is the relationship connect here?
Sure.
Ms. Federighel?
Sure, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, we would have, off the top of my head, I can't recall specifically what members we might have serving on those task forces, advisory committees, but I could definitely take a look at that. And, you know, we do a lot with, Mr. Zlanka mentioned his annual meeting and his delegates approving policy resolutions and things like that. We go through a similar process, and then we publish our resolutions and make sure that legislators are aware of our concerns. Bruce Clavin, who would be representing us as well, would be having dialogues there. And we definitely, if there's anything specific that you think we should be weighing in on that we're not, I'm sure we'd love to, try to help out with that. So we, just try to keep abreast of all those different opportunities and think that those opportunities for rural development are very important. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Senator Kielash.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My question is, does the co-op actively go out to seek the trends in new business or possible businesses in the agriculture environment or in energy environment, or is it depending on the co-op whether they choose to do it? So I don't know how much support services the network gives the co-ops to try to pursue new business.
Actually, for Mr. Chairman and Senator, from the business development side of things, one thing I should have mentioned by way of introductions is that we have a sister association called the Cooperative Development Services. Their executive director is Kevin Edberg. I actually share an office with Mr. Edberg, and they are more the business development side of sort of the broader community. We do sort of the governmental affairs and education side of things, but just generally I think that in rural areas what you see are in urban areas as well, in the cooperative community, you see oftentimes just a need being recognized in the marketplace, something that's not being fulfilled. are offered by the marketplace, and you see, you know, rural, you know, partners coming together and maybe starting a business to fill that need.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kulesh.
And my question is, I'm interested in the local foods movement. Mm-hmm. I think it's a growing part of the agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if there's any cooperatives in the state that are trying to address getting those local foods to the marketplace, because it seems to be its size and transportation issues and a lot of other things, and the demand is growing for that.
Ms. Rodrigo.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, actually the Twin Cities has the highest concentration of food cooperatives of any metro in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of healthy activity going on with local foods and food cooperatives in the Twin Cities. But
Let me follow
you
up.
Have a follow up, Senator
Kulesh? Yeah, and that is that it's not the co-ops in the cities. It's who's supplying the food to the cities. Is there any co-ops around the agriculture side of that developing, or areas that are looking to try to be able to meet the demand for that local foods?
Ms. Rodrigo?
Mr. Chair, sort of maybe the distribution side of things you're looking at.
Distribution, right. Whether, mm-hmm. There's more people interested in local foods than there's availability of it.
Sure. I think that's a great observation. There's a lot of interest at the local level around Minnesota in that. And I think that the cooperatives that are already working with their local farmers are trying to key on to different opportunities wherever they might be available. So I think that's where you see a lot of the new entrepreneurial activity popping up, and maybe some new cooperatives being started. You know, there might be some marketing cooperatives that are being started. It just kind of depends. But if you have more interest in that, I could connect you with Kevin Edberg at Cooperative Development Services,
thank
and
you.
He might be able to help you out there.
That would be great.
Okay. Senator Dames?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if you could tell me what your thoughts are as far as how Obamacare is going to affect or have an impact on your health care co-op as far as what you're working on now.
Ms. Rodrigo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, the federal health care reform, and actually we do have a health care coordinator that specializes in this, and so I'm not necessarily an expert on our health care activities, but I could connect you with her if you're interested in more information. There were a couple of aspects of the federal health care reform that ended up leading to some changes in our draft 40 square plans, I guess, so to speak. So I don't necessarily know the specifics on that. So I think there were just some changes that were made as a result of that. But really there wasn't a lot of effect. We can continue moving forward with our program efforts, and right now we're in the regulatory review process, I guess, for lack of a better term, but should be hopefully coming out sooner rather than later.
Thank you.
Okay. No further questions? Okay, thank you very much, Amy.
Thank you, Mr.
Have a good rest of the day.
Thank you. No more ice dams.
Go away. Thank you. Next, we'll visit about horses. Mr. Dayan from the Minnesota horse industry. And again, members, you have a paper in your materials to support the testimony. And please identify yourself for the tape. And I apologize, Ms. Rodrigo, for that microphone. We had some technical difficulties here, but we had backup, so we're ready. We could hear you. So.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Ag Committee. My name is David Dayan. I'm a lifelong horseman and industry spokesman for the horse industry. I'm accompanied by Dr. Tracy Turner, who's president of the Minnesota Equine Veterinary Practitioners and also chair of the Minnesota Horse Council Legislative Committee, and Krishana Martinson, who is with the University of Minnesota Equine Extension Service. We're here today to give you an overview of the horse industry in the state of Minnesota. It's vital to the rural communities and part of Minnesota's livestock industry. Nationwide, the horse industry directly produces goods and services of $25.3 billion and a total of impact of $112.1 billion on the U.S. gross domestic product. The industry's contribution to the U.S. GDP is greater than the motion picture services, the railroad transportation, furniture and fixture manufacturing, and the tobacco products manufacturing industries. Minnesota has a diverse equine industry that propels both rural and urban communities. Minnesota is home to diverse equine breeds and disciplines, a racing industry, college programs, various scales of operation, major equine industry leaders, and numerous equine organizations. Unlike other species of livestock, in which the value lies in the quantity and size of the animal, the value of the horse lies in the quality, breeding, and its ability to perform a certain task. The size of our industry can probably best be shown by the fact that we have the largest single-species livestock show in the state of Minnesota, the Minnesota Horse Expo. It represents 83 different breeds, over 500 vendors and companies, and is attended by over 60,000 people. Our horse population is approximately 150,000, located on 13,000 farms. They're used for multiple uses: racing, exhibition, working, therapeutic use, recreational riding, driving, breeding, and sales. The horse industry is an intensive agricultural use. The majority of the horse owners own 14 horses on approximately 30 acres of property. Related industries are the veterinarians, their clinics, their surgical facilities, farriers, farrier schools, and farrier equipment. The state of Minnesota has one of the most prominent farrier schools in the nation, equine dentist, trucks and trailer sales, English and Western clothing, bulk grain dealers, processed feed dealers, feed stores, hay growers and suppliers, straw, shavings processors and suppliers, horse stall manufacturers and sales, gates and portable panels manufacturing and sales, horse barn builders, horse fencing manufacturing and sales, facilities and equipment insurance, as well as the equipment parts repair and labor. Horses are the raw material for many products, including byproducts from slaughter, as well as materials collected from live horses. The main product that we have is the horse itself. It's the most valuable entity. But from the horse, we can derive the pregnant mare urine that's used in estrogen jugs for women, known as Premarin, platelet-rich plasma, which is used for a botulinum antitoxin, tetanus antitoxins, rabies antitoxins, and wound infections in neonates. They're also used for fat-derived stem cells, bone marrow-derived stem cells. Purified horse serum is used in cell cultures, black widow spider antivenom, snake bite antivenom, and interleukin receptor antagonist protein is used as an anti-inflammatory. Also, anti-rejection drugs used in organ transplant. Horse hide is used for boots, motorcycle leathers, flight jackets, holsters, gun belts, a few baseballs, baseball gloves, hockey gloves, and the hair is used in hair pieces and bow strings for instruments, gelatin, cosmetic and beauty products, and of course the horse meat as food for human and carnivorous animals. Although the meat is controversial, it's consumed worldwide and is also imported into the U.S., and Minnesota imports 687.6 metric tons in 2008. The economic impact of our industry. Recently, an impact study was done of trail-related activities in Minnesota, and it was published by the DNR, in which just horseback riding amounted to $600 million of economic impact. Horseback riding is a small, insignificant part of our entire industry. The only economic impact study we have dates back to 2004, and it estimated the economic impact to be $1 billion. Based on the numbers of this recent DNR study, I would guess that if you were to do a current economic impact study, you would find that our industry would probably exceed $2 billion in economic impact to the state. Our legislative priorities this year are to be recognized as livestock in Minnesota. We'd like to be treated legislatively the same as all other livestock species in the state of Minnesota. We would like to be included in the agricultural statistics that are published annually by the Department of Agriculture. And our other goal is to get an updated economic impact study to better determine the full impact of the equine industry. With that, I would stand for any questions that any of the committee members may have.
Okay. Any questions for the panel? Senator Brown.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Magnus. I'm surprised, or at least I didn't realize that horses are not recognized as livestock in Minnesota. Can you tell me how many states do recognize horses as livestock? And also, up to this point, what has the reasoning been behind not recognizing horses?
Mr. Dan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, last year we were able to get a bill passed through the legislature that defined horses as livestock in the state of Minnesota, but it has an amended language on it which says that that definition does not apply for property tax purposes. Our goal is to have horses identified as livestock and to be treated the same as all other species of livestock in the state. As far as nationally, I can't give you the exact numbers. I don't know if either one of them, the people with me, would have the exact number of states. But I think, according to most of the data that we've received, that all states recognize them as livestock.
Okay. Senator Kielash?
Mr. Chair, one of the questions I have is, you said we imported a whole bunch of several thousand pounds of horse meat into the state. I'm wondering if we have any processing plants for horses in the state to get all the byproducts that are coming out of these animals as part of our industry.
In 2007, the federal government defunded the meat inspectors, and that forced the shutdown of all slaughter plants in the United States dealing in horses. At the present time, and since 2007, all horses are exported either to Canada or Mexico for slaughter, and then the meat is re-imported into the United States. And the amount we imported, according to a study done by Senator Dill, in 2008, we imported 687.6 metric tons.
Just to follow up on that, and the byproducts, we have no way of getting the because we don't have a slaughterhouse, we don't have any way of getting the gelatin or all the other stuff that comes out of that process that are contributing to other industries.
Mr. Dan,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Kielash, to my understanding, most of these products would have to be imported. And I understand that the gelatin and those byproducts of slaughter. A lot of these horse products are taken from live animals. A lot of the antitoxins and blood plasma and the like are harvested from live animals and not from slaughtered animals.
And within the state, I take it. Within Minnesota?
Within Minnesota, yes.
Okay. Senator Nelson, did you have a question also?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you could speak to me a little bit about how you think the Racino proposal might impact the horse industry. There's been some talk about that. I'd just like your views.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I have an economic impact study that was done by the state of Pennsylvania that recently adopted a Racino, and their economic impact increased $3 billion based on the Racino being adopted in the state. And this is a recent economic impact study that was just done by the state of Pennsylvania on that subject.
Senator Nelson?
Follow up, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know how our horse industry compares to Pennsylvania, but would you anticipate a similar type of economic impact here, or what number is there?
Mr. Dan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, currently, depending upon which source you go to, the state of Minnesota ranks someplace between fourth and ninth in the nation in overall horse population. I'm not sure exactly where Pennsylvania ranks. I'd have to go back in my documents to find out. But I think that we have comparable, if not a greater, horse population in the state of Minnesota. And just as diverse, we have one of the, in Canterbury Park, we have one of the best performing privately owned racetracks in the nation. The Sampson Management has been kind of the poster child for the industry of how the little engine that could. We've outperformed our competition in many ways, and the only thing holding us back right now would be the Racino issues. So,
thank you, Mr. Dayton.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, of that Pennsylvania study, how much of that was related to the gambling portion of it, and how much was related to the horse industry?
This is just related to the horse industry, not the gambling industry. This is economic impact study applied only to the horse industry.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how doing a Racino increases the number of horses needed to run the races, or could you just give me a background on that?
All right. Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, we're just like other professional sports, although you don't seem to look at, we don't get looked at that way, but we have our professional athletes, and they all want million-dollar contracts too. So obviously, the best horses go where the highest purses are. The better the horses, the better the quality of the races, the more fans you draw, the more money is bet on the horses. And if the purses are bigger, there's more breeding going on because there's more horses being bred to run for those larger purses. Those state-bred horses carry a higher value than non-state-bred horses because of various programs that are set aside for premiums to state-bred horses. So therefore, the breeding industry is going to enlarge because we can get more money for our racing prospects, and so on and so on and so on.
Thank you.
I'll just point out to in conversations I've had with friends from Kentucky, for example, and all of us are recognize Kentucky as the horse racing state. At least I did in my mind, and with the Kentucky Derby, the most famous one of those. But there was several articles I saw in the papers and in talking to friends of mine in Kentucky involved in agriculture there. There is significant concern about the decline of the horse industry in Kentucky. Most of those folks are going to Pennsylvania to race, or West Virginia, who both have gaming-supported racetracks, several of racetracks there. And that kind of shocked me. So I know it's something that, that I've been made aware of. So there is certainly some economic advantages there. Anything else? Dr. Turner, do you have anything to add, or Ms. Martinson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would the only thing I'd like to add is that the horse industry in this state is a big part of the agricultural industry of this state, and we'd just like to be treated that way. I mean, I think the figures really are closer to a $2 billion part of the industry. And to ask your question about how much of a bump can we expect, a $3 billion bump? I don't know. The sky's the limit, because every state, however the thoroughbred industry goes, the rest of the horse industry goes. And that's proven again and again in every state in the union that has horse industries that are very important to it. And I think you'll see the same thing here, that you'll see a big bump for the horse industry.
Okay. And thank you, Ms. Martinson, for hosting the House Ag Committee in the rain, I guess. Quite a facility you've got out there, the equine facility. And if we get a chance, members, we'll take some time and go out to the U and look at some of the facilities there on the ag campus. But certainly this equine facility was impressive to me. There's no doubt about that. So, all right, thank you very much. For your testimony.
In closing, Mr. Chair, I would offer the invitation to any member of the Ag Committee that would like to visit some of the horse facilities in our state. We can take you to many diverse facilities that are out there, anything from the racehorse breeding industry to the jumping horse industry, to any of them, the cutting horse industry, any of a multitude of the different operations that are out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. And I would point out, too, I see Senator Rosen wants to get recognized, but I would point out the rodeo industry, too. We don't want to neglect them. So I don't know if I was ahead of you, Senator Rosen.
Well, I could have absolutely jumped in on that one.
But I don't know if we're going to have testimony on rodeo bulls at a hearing.
But that takes us a whole other direction. But I did want to say that Dr. Martinson is on the website, and the Minnesota Horse Expo is April 29th through the 1st. So that would be very fun if we could incorporate that somehow.
Well, we should have a ag committee tour of that. Really should.
And I'm sure there's a rodeo about that time somewhere, too.
Okay. If I can make one more statement, Chairman,
yes,
I hate to interrupt,
yes,
but to follow that up is, as a member of the expo board, I would like to invite each and every one of you to come down, and we will treat you to the expo. There is a rodeo every day during the expo, and if you want to see the horse industry, come down and see it. I think you will be amazed.
Okay, would you folks get in contact with Libby or Jennifer and get us the dates on that, and we'll get that out, and we'll see what we can do. I'd love to go down there and see that. Okay.
I apologize, Senator Rosen, but every time I give one of these presentations, I forget somebody in the horse industry because it's that big and that diverse.
I don't know if we'd have any celebrity rides in the rodeo or not, but that's something we can think about. Chair of the Energy Committee, maybe. All right, thank you very much, testimony. Okay, we'll get into the banking since we have Banking Day here coming up. First one up is Farm Credit Services with Mr. Nicely and our friend Mr. Appitz. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen, and please state your name, Mark, and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Mark Nisley. I believe there's a bio in the packet that we distributed, so I won't spend a lot of time going over that other than to say that I'll be celebrating my 30th anniversary in the in farm lending and the agricultural sector coming up this summer. So it's been a very interesting career and very touching to have worked with all these farm families over the years. Joining me today is John Appitz of Messerly & Kramer. John represents the Farm Credit System as our lobbyist here at the Capitol, and they have done so for more than 20 years now. So we enjoy our working relationship with John and Messerly & Kramer, and encourage you to get in touch with them if you have any questions on any of our legislative positions or anything really in regards to agriculture. I do want to note that I also serve on the Rural Finance Authority Board, over which this committee has jurisdiction, so I wanted to make mention of that. In fact, we have a board meeting tomorrow at the Department of Ag, so one of the events that we have during the course of the year where we all get together and have a speaker come in. So some of you may have been invited to that, so maybe we'll see you tomorrow at the RFA meeting. I'm going to reference the packet as we go through the testimony today. I'm going to begin with a document that has a farm credit emblem at the top and spend a little time just talking about the history of the system. The farm credit system was authorized and created in 1916, so we'll be celebrating our 95th anniversary this year as a system. We were really set up and created to provide sound, constructive, and reliable credit and financial services for rural America and agriculture. As was mentioned earlier, the farm credit system is set up under the form of cooperative ownership. And one of the things that I want to highlight on your little flow chart here that we distributed is that this all starts with the member borrowers. The farmers themselves own the farm credit associations. The farm credit associations then in turn own the district wholesale banks. And we'll spend a little bit more time talking about the various entities that are located in the state a little later on in the presentation. And then in turn, the wholesale banks work together with the funding corporation to actually access the debt markets. We are not a depository institution. We work as a conduit to issue debt and move that debt from Wall Street and the global financial markets to Main Street and rural America. We serve every county in the state of Minnesota under a federal charter. Just as importantly, from a national standpoint, to give you a little bit of the background on the scale of the system, we have over $150 billion, I believe it's actually approaching $160 billion in loans outstanding nationally. There's over 500,000 member borrowers and farmers that do business and own and govern the farm credit system, and over 10,000 employees nationally. And again, most of those retail operations are delivered through retail services are delivered through the retail associations, and there are approximately 90 retail associations across the country, three of which are chartered to serve parts of the state of Minnesota, United FCS, which is headquartered in Wilmer, of which I am the CEO, AgStar, which is headquartered out of Mankato, and Ag Country, which is headquartered out of Fargo. All three of those associations serve territory in multiple states. Both AgStar and United serve counties both in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and Ag Country actually serves a portion of North Dakota in addition to the Red River Valley of Minnesota. In addition to the Farm Credit Associations and the retail operations delivered out of those associations, within the state, we are fortunate to have AgriBank located in St. Paul. AgriBank is one of those wholesale banks that I referenced earlier that are owned by the individual associations that utilize them to get their funding and other types of services to help with our operations. CoBank also operates within the state. CoBank has a charter that not only allows them to serve associations as a wholesale bank in other parts of the country, but CoBank also serves cooperatives directly. So a number of the customers that are listed, again, on the handout that I passed out, in addition to farmers and ranchers, agribusinesses, and rural homeowners, the list of farm credit owners and users also includes cooperatives, rural utilities, and other types of farm businesses. Primarily what we do as associations within the state is offer real estate financing and capital financing for capital improvements, farm equipment, those types of things, in addition to operating for farm operators to cover their input costs and cover cash flow. We also offer leasing, a number of different types of business and succession planning services, real estate appraisals, crop insurance, and a number of the associations in the state also offer farm tax preparation and farm record services as part of our retail commitment to our customers. In addition to that, we have recently been involved in a number of rural investments, working with other agencies and other financial institutions to provide funding as part of multi-lender groups for various types of rural infrastructure, including health care facilities and water and sewer and those types of things where we really have a need in rural America. We've been approached and have worked closely with other institutions and agencies in providing some of those, some of that funding as well. I wanted to talk a little bit about the cooperative structure again and really emphasize the importance of my presenting here is not in regards to our association, United FCS. I'm really here representing the 5,000 or 5,100 shareholders, which are farmers, your constituents out in rural Minnesota. Combined, the Farm Credit Associations in this state serve over 26,000 farmers and ranchers, and they are the owners and the true beneficiaries of the system, the way it's established, and the services that we offer. Another benefit, and Amy touched on this earlier, of the cooperative structure is that we are able to then, as a cooperative, return our excess capital back to our shareholders in the form of patronage. And I can't speak for the other institutions in the state, but I know that United FCS has returned over $50 million in cash to our shareholders over the since 2002, since our institution was put together. And it's been a real blessing to put those checks back in producers' hands every year. Although the ag economy is doing quite well now, thank you, with the exception of a few sectors, the ability for us to return some of our profits back to our shareholders at the end of every fiscal cycle has been welcome and really something that our shareholders have come to count on. So that's you know, a real advantage as to operating, or a real advantage around operating as a cooperative. I would like to say that I believe also included in your packet was our legislative positions. As I mentioned before, we worked together as a state in putting our legislative positions together. And I guess what I would like to leave you with in terms of our positions and the impression of agriculture is that farmers are good stewards of the environment. And really what we're looking at from a legislative standpoint is to allow this good economic engine, and I would think you would all agree that agriculture has been the one bright spot in this economy, at least in the last 3 years, and has really done a good job of keeping a number of the Midwestern states in a positive growth from an economic standpoint, but really recognize the importance of agriculture and recognize that the farmers are there. They're really good stewards of the environment, and they're doing everything in their power to make sure that they are taking good care of the environment and their livelihood, really. The other thing I would support and wanted to mention was that it's really imperative, I think, that if we do come across, and I know there's some regulatory reform that's taking place right now and is being discussed, but that we base those things on science, that we try and take emotion out of some of the thought processes that have gone into previous regulations, and that we really create an environment that our producers can operate in an economic, successful manner, at the same time, again, as I mentioned, be able to protect the environment the way they have. So we encourage you to continue to keep those things in mind as we go into this legislative session. One of the things that we will be distributing to the committee that we didn't have enough copies of prior to putting the packets together is a handout on the farm credit system in the state. And I did want to point out, because it's something that I feel passionately about, serving on the Rural Finance Authority, but also in my years in working with the system. But we have, as a state, produced and made over $1.1 billion in loans to young farmers and over $1 billion loans to small farmers in this state. So we really try and pride ourselves and I think do a good job as a system in serving all sectors of agriculture. And in particular, whatever we can do as a system and you as a legislature can do to encourage young producers, making sure that we're doing all we can do with the RFA authority. And in particular, we've expressed an interest in the possibility of expanding RFA into a guarantee-type program whereby we might be able to do a better job of leveraging some of the dollars that are appropriated each year by this body to spread it over more producers and really possibly make better use of that in this day and age. So it's the RFA has been a good tool, both from a farm credit standpoint as well as my banking friends would tell you, to assist in getting these young producers started, and we'd really like to encourage the continued use of that. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Okay, any questions? All right, thank you very much for the testimony.
You're welcome. I would like to mention and extend an invitation to our February 8th legislative reception. I believe we've moved that back, the starting time back to 6:15, to allow for a committee hearing that you have that afternoon. So,
thanks. We appreciate that. We will have a joint hearing with the Environment Committee that day. So, yeah, we appreciate you moving your reception back for us. You do want to attend. So, Mr. Appetz?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just briefly, John Appetz with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and we've represented these good folks at Farm Credit Services for about 20 years now here at the Capitol. Behind me is David Ladd, so that you all get a peek at David. David's kind of the ringleader of what we call the Ag Mafia, which gets together a couple of times every other month, and you're all invited to sit down and have conversations about agriculture, issues facing agriculture, and issues before the legislature. David is our godfather. In lots of ways, and we look forward to having you join us there. If I could just say just two other quick things. You folks took some action on an environmental permitting bill that speeds this up. I know you've inspired the governor to move forward on this. He's looked at this. That's been on our agenda for a long time, and it's very important work that you're doing, and moving that process along, particularly for producers in this state, is, I think, both commendable and absolutely necessary. He listed some important testimony, and moving that along was very helpful. The folks that are on the legislative committee that guides my words to you are all producers. They're borrowers of the farm credit system. They are members of the boards of directors, and they serve on the legislative committee that sets our policy positions. And you can take a look at them. The quick version, the cliff notes is on the front, the detail is in the back. But these are producers who are concerned about what you're doing up here. I told Mark, when we sit down and talk to you folks, tell them what you do, tell them who you are, tell them what you do, and tell them why you should care. And why you should care is the 27,000 people that we work with who borrow from the farm credit system, who really care not just about reasonable rates and terms, but about the ability to produce in this state. And to compete in this state against other states all around us. Amy knows very well that Wisconsin's got one heck of a livestock grant program that they got started over there that we struggled with. That's our competition. That's what we need to keep up with. And finally, Mr. Chairman, that Section 179 program that you have been promoting for several years is a darn good idea, and I hope your colleagues help you move that along. Accelerated expensing of capital and capital improvements in agriculture and other small businesses is a darn good idea, and it would help a whole lot of folks. So we're very supportive of that, and we appreciate the chance to come before the committee.
Okay, thank you very much.
Come see us on the 8th after your hearing.
Okay, and Mr. Ladd, when's the next Ag Mafia dinner?
Mr. Chairman, February 17th at Mancini's. Anyone's welcome.
Can I come to that, too?
I suppose.
Okay.
No, yes, of course.
Senator Rosen, did you have a point?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is kind of a, you know, there's some community banks are concerned about the direction that AgStar has been investing in as far as, you know, hospitals. Is that part of the direction that the credits?
I can't speak to any, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I can't speak to any specific activities of the other associations. I do know that some of the farm credit associations have been involved with assisting in the financing of hospitals and medical facilities. Typically, we are doing that from a United FCS perspective with other lending institutions, community banks included. So. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the concern would be, but it's something that our customers and our members and our producers in rural America have asked us to get involved in, and we've done it. As John mentioned, we are governed by a group of farmer members, and so they're very, very tuned in and very aware of the importance of medical facilities in rural Minnesota and those types of things, and have allowed most of the associations to participate in those types of credits and issues. But we'd be happy to address if there are any specific, you know, questions. I can direct them to the associations that are involved.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen?
I don't know, and it's not an accusation. It was just, I think, really more of a concern in the last couple of years, but it's good to hear that there is cooperation and some agenda to advance the rural economic development, and I think that's what I would like to hear, is that we're all in this together, so it's not them against you, or that you're going to do the best for the community and for agriculture in whole. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen,
Appetz.
When we come before you, kind of as a banking institution here in the state of Minnesota, there are battles that go on out at the federal level, but I think we consistently join arms both as a lending community here at the state capitol and as well with fellow producers across the state. Rural development is part of what we are supposed to be doing. We're all working at it. Heavenly days, we know there's not enough capital out there in a lot of instances for the types of improvements we need in our rural communities. So sometimes we'll stretch the envelope a bit, but we're going to find ways to work together to get the facilities that are needed.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Nicely,
if I could, and Amy mentioned her presentation, upwards of over $3 billion of loans outstanding. It actually went over $4 billion at the end of the year. And of that $4 billion of loans and credits outstanding in the system, while we are actively engaged in some of these rural infrastructure needs and providing financing for those, it's actually a pretty small part of what we do. Most of what we do is serve farmers and their credit needs out in the country. So while we commit to helping out with some of these projects, it's actually a very small part of what we do from a capital standpoint. And as a result, the boards of directors at all these associations, mine included, really look at these things very carefully and make sure that they're the right kinds of investments to make before we get involved.
Senator Rosen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you made reference that agriculture is strong, except in a couple of sectors. And I'd like to just ask you your opinion on the pork industry and what you foresee that industry and the changes it's going to go through because of the struggles that they've had in the past and what they're struggling right now, of course, with corn prices. And is it going to be a whittling out of the some of the producers? Are we going to get larger producers?
Mr. Nicely?
Well, I'll clarify my qualifications. I'm not an economist or an educator. Clearly, the pork industry has gone through some pretty tough times. When commodity prices went up, their inputs went up. When corn and their input costs went up significantly and prices went down, suffered enormous economic losses. There were a number of operators that you can't almost prepare for the kind of downturn that they went through, to be honest. And that said, that there's still a lot of producers that have made it through this cycle and have made some really good inroads or really good progress the last 6 months to a year in improving their balance sheet and getting earnings back to the positive. Typically, these types of economic challenges do result in change in structure and ownership. So whether we'll see any more consolidation or you'll just see consolidation shift between parties, I think a majority of the consolidation that took place in the industry over my career hasn't changed significantly because of the economy. I think that the staying power, in effect, is probably greater with the players that are in that industry now than there were 25 years ago or 30 years ago. And I think you can see that in the supply numbers. And, again, I'm not an economist, but years ago when pork prices would go down or the profitability wasn't there, individual farmers or producers would quit producing pork. They would just get out of the business. And we really didn't see that during this last cycle, in part because these farm operations are really of a scale that they can't just get in and get out of it all the time. They have to find a way and maintain their staying power. So I'm fairly proud of the industry and the fact that they went into this with a pretty good financial footing, suffered through some pretty severe economic times, and are still hanging on and making progress again. So.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have the Independent Community Bankers, Mr. Skilbright. How are you today?
I'm very good, Mr. Chair. David Skilbright, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you today and talk a little bit about how community bankers are part of the rural financial services sector. I think your agenda is spot on with respect to the title and the function that we play, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that today. First of all, for the new members on the committee, I represent the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, a statewide association dedicated to representing the interest of community banks across the state. You'll find those in inner city neighborhoods, suburban neighborhoods, but the vast majority are in greater Minnesota. And as part of that fact, that really puts us into your committee agenda today. The characteristics and advantages of community banks, I hope that I leave you with this kind of model. They're relationship-based. A lot of financial institutions out there, but where they have different organization structures, they may deliver their services differently, where they get their funding, those are the things that separate those institutions. And community bankers have a model for providing those services, and it's really basically a relationship-based model. What does that mean? Well, number one, we're extremely customer-focused. We provide face-to-face service, which means that our lenders are accessible to their customers. They can go to their office as opposed to dial a 1-800 number. Our bankers know our customers. Often our second, third, fourth generation bankers, like other small businesses in Minnesota. We use local deposits for local loans. We make local decisions on those local loans. They're not sent to somewhere else for a decision based on numbers, but they're a local decision made by the people that own the bank and know the customers. They have a local commitment. Many of you perhaps don't know that there are nearly 200 bank charters in Minnesota that are over 100 years old. That provides some stability to those communities that they serve that can't be replaced. Character counts on those loans. Community bankers consider character, family history, discretionary spending. Character counts. It's just not a number and a face in front of the lender. Small business lenders. Community banks are small businesses. And as such, they really understand the needs and challenges of the small businesses that we live next to, work with, and loan to. Minnesota has the third highest number of chartered banks in the nation, which with about 400 charters. You add the branches that those charters have, and that result is that nearly every small town in Minnesota has a bank there, a banker there, a lender there that is going to support that community and support that rural economic development. Community bankers, as I said, are key small business lenders. Let me give you an example. According to the Small Business Administration Office of Advocacy, community banks across the country provide 35% of the total dollar amount of loans to small businesses, despite comprising just 12% of industry assets. We're out there in small businesses, and ag lending is really our niche. SBA lending in Minnesota in federal fiscal year 2010 was actually up 14% compared to federal fiscal year 2009. And in federal fiscal year 2010, 278 Minnesota lenders combined to make 2,352 SBA loans, totaling $513 million to Minnesota small businesses. The vast majority of those SBA loans were made by community banks. As far as the products that we offer to small businesses, I don't think you'll be surprised to hear that we provide lines of credit, equipment loans, and building loans. With respect to the ag economy, having our banks in the rural area, it's logical that we are major ag lenders. And another example of that would be previous testimony talked about the Rural Finance Authority. Approximately 90% of all RFA agreements are made with community banks. And when you look at the loans that the RFA made from 2008 to 2010, about 64% of all RFA loans were originated by community banks. And again, the products offered are going to be a combination of lines of credit so farmers can get their planting done in the spring, et cetera, machinery or equipment loans, and finally land or building loans. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that, just remind you that community bankers are small businesses and a major source of lending to small businesses, be they ag producers, ag-related businesses, or small businesses in greater Minnesota. That concludes my testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Skillbred. Any questions? Well, thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your support of rural Minnesota, and also previous testifiers also, too. Thank you very much, Dave. Next, we have one more presentation for today, and that's from the Minnesota Bankers Association, all the way from God's country in southwest Minnesota.
Now, Mr. Chair, I thought God's country was Detroit Lakes.
Well, maybe there's one of them from here, too, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Who's going to lead this off? Welcome to the committee. Okay, that looks good. We have Tess Rice, Steve Daggett, and Greg Berger. Welcome to the committee, and please announce your name and for the tape, and tell us about your day, how that's going today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. We appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you today. My name is Tess Rice. I'm General Counsel and Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Bankers Association. To my left is Greg Berger from MinWest Bank in Laverne and a former president of the Minnesota Bankers Association. To my right is Steve Daggett. He's president of Midwest Bank in Detroit Lakes and is the chair of our Government Relations Committee. The Minnesota Bankers Association is a banking trade association that represents about 93% of the banks in Minnesota. There are about 404 banks in Minnesota and another 38 that do business here. Ag banks in the state are those that have more than 14.6% of their loan portfolio in ag-related loans. And so in Minnesota, we have about 196 banks that you would consider ag banks, and there are another 145 that do some sort of agricultural lending. So there are actually very few that aren't involved in some way in agricultural lending. Those would mostly be your savings and loans, who focus mostly on mortgage loans, and then your banks in urban and suburban areas. More than 88% of all farm banks were profitable in 2009. And 98.9% of them were categorized as well capitalized, which is the highest capital rating that's given by our bank regulators. So ag banks have been kind of the shining star of the banking industry in the last few years. They are the largest providers of credit to the agricultural industry. They make more than 50% of all farm and ranch loans. And they have generally seen the demand for farm credit rise. Agricultural loans for farm real estate and production increased 6.1% in 2009 from 2008, so there has been some growth there. There are competitors in the ag lending arena, as was mentioned earlier. Farm credit is one of those competitors. And it was said that we do work together in some ways. But our platform of our Government Relations Committee is that we oppose any competition when it's unfair. And we don't believe that any government-sponsored enterprises should be competing directly with banks for their business. That is all I have, and I wanted to turn it over to Greg Berger and give you an overview of ag lending in his area of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Berger, would you talk a little bit about some of the rural economic development, in your case, the wind and some of those, too, if you could get into that, Greg. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Chairman, Mr. Chairman, and Senators, for the opportunity to come and speak today. My name is Greg Berger. I'm President and CEO of Midwest Bank in Laverne, Minnesota. We are $169 million in asset size. We employ 29 people currently, 29 good Southwest Minnesota folk. Our loan portfolio is made up of roughly $121 million in loans. Of those loans, 50% of those are direct ag-related loans, although in a town like Laverne, Minnesota, much of the remainder of that is to agriculturally based business enterprises within our community. We offer a full line of ag product, ag loan products, operating loans, term equipment loans, as well as ag real estate loans. And no, I haven't made any $8,000 an acre loans lately. So just dispel that rumor. Yeah. So.
I think those folks had the money in the bank.
Probably so, Mr. Chair. Competition for ag loans is keen, obviously. As has been mentioned, agricultural enterprise these days is doing rather well based upon production being probably at its height in the 35-plus years I've been involved in lending to farmers. The production is phenomenal. And that, coupled with the prices these days, is certainly creating a positive economy for both agriculture and for the communities that depend highly on agriculture. The competition includes probably my primary competitor continues to be Farm Credit Services, although my other banking companions would like to steal customers, too, if they get the opportunity. So... As far as how the economy is doing, the ag economy obviously is riding pretty high right now. The last few years have with some exceptions, dairy and as the hog market's been mentioned, are probably two exceptions to that, but production agriculture otherwise is doing very well. Outlook for the ag economy, I was asked to comment on that. As we are reminded by our regulators on a regular basis, there seems to be a lot more chips in the middle of the table these days, given land prices, the constant uptick of input costs. And obviously that raises risks for producers as well as those of us who finance those producers. So we are being asked to underwrite our loans rather keenly these days and to look hard at the ag business sector. I'm happy to report that most of my customers find themselves in very good positions financially in terms of working capital and so forth. So I happen to believe, personally, we're not going to see another downturn as we did in the 80s and early 90s. But that, having said that, there's always, when you're riding high, there's always more downside potential than upside. Mr. Chairman, you ask about wind towers. There continues to be a going business for wind. I think wind energy took a little bit of a backseat last year given some of the prices on fossil fuels to generate electricity, but I think future, certainly wind is going to be part of our economy in Southwest Minnesota. And obviously ethanol production, while one questions $6 corn, how far you can go with ethanol production at $6 corn, I still maintain that ethanol is here to stay. There will be alternative options for ethanol production, biomass and whatnot, and that will stay in the forefront of our economy on a local basis. So,
Mr. Berger, could you just spend a couple minutes talking to us about the plant in Laverne that formerly was an ethanol plant, because I'm not sure hardly anyone here knows about it, but if you'd just take a couple of minutes, Greg, and talk about that.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I'd be glad to do that. I'll let you know what I know, which I'm not a chemist, nor do I pretend to know all that much about the inside of an ethanol plant. But Laverne had one of the first ethanol plants, I believe, in the state of Minnesota, built just outside our city limits. And that ethanol plant's been in production now for 15 or 16 years, I believe, if my memory serves me. It was a co-op, one of the original co-op ethanol plants owned by the farmer producers. I think the original shares were $10,000 a piece, and of course at the time everyone looked at that as pretty much venture capital, because I think ethanol was at its infancy at that time, or at least corn ethanol production. Recently our plant was sold to a bigger concern, and their plan is to retrofit that plant to produce a higher level fuel rather than ethanol, but
biobutanol.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, sir. And that they're going to retrofit that plant now. At last count, I believe the sale of that, the $10,000 shares, fetched about $70,000 a piece in that sale, and the net return to the producers, I think, over the time the plant's been in business, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 to 15 times their original investment. So it has been a phenomenal piece of economics for my farm customers, many of my farm customers, as well as our community. So,
okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Berger. Mr. Daggett, do you have what's going on up in your area?
Beautiful Detroit Lakes.
Okay.
My name is Steve Daggett, and thank you, Mr. Chairperson and the Senators, for allowing me to be here today. My name is Steve Daggett. I'm from Midwest Bank. I'm the President and CEO of Midwest Bank. We have offices in six communities, all in West Central Minnesota. Detroit Lakes is our largest community and our largest office. We have five other rural communities, all within 1 hour of Detroit Lakes. All of the communities are ag-based, even Detroit Lakes, but especially in our smaller markets. And as Mr. Berger said, that even our side economy has really benefited by the ag economy. And we've been very fortunate. Midwest Bank is a $260 million bank. We have about $230 million in loans, 75 employees. Our loan volume, based on the time of the year, varies from about upper 20s to mid-30s in terms of percent of ag loans. So obviously when the ag economy does well, Midwest Bank does well. And and the last couple years have been very well. We have row crops. We have some small grains. We do have some dairy, and obviously the dairy world is okay now, but, I mean, it's not as strong because of the struggles they had over the last couple years. But overall, the ag economy is solid, and it's fun to do annual reviews because people are able to pay back their credits, which is great. There is just one thing that I just want to touch, because I know a senator, I believe, who left, asked about the concerns that some of the community banks had about the farm credit on some of their rural projects, and that is a legitimate concern. I knew when I was on the Minnesota Bankers Association board, I know that had been brought up by members of at least a couple projects where the banks did not get an opportunity to be part of that, where there was not a partnership. And I'm sure there are some examples. There's no doubt in my mind that there are some examples where there has been a partnership, but where we get concerned is when there isn't that partnership. And one other thing that I know one of the previous gentlemen testifying talked about the Young Farmer Program. Our senior lender came from the farm credit world, and as he stated to us, generally what we see, there's no doubt in my mind that there's a lot of loans made under the Young Farmer Program through farm credit, but what, as he's mentioned, in a lot of cases it's a very strong entity that's facilitating a transfer to the next generation. But the true young farmers are the ones trying to get into farming. The more not as well-heeled ones are the ones that we find significantly going to the local banks and where we work with a FSA and try to get loans put together. So those were the couple things I did want to bring up related to that testimony.
Thank you. We recently, I saw a presentation by our state demographer, and one of the concerns he pointed out was the age of people doing actually production farming, because you know, they're nearing 60 years old on an average, and so someone needs to replace them. So any support the banking, financial industry can support to folks coming in, that would be appreciated. Need to do it. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
and I don't know who would want to address this, but because I am a farmer and I know how farmers like to spend money to stimulate the economy, and I know it's pretty good times right now for ag, but things go up and things go down. Are you seeing a reduction in the debt load that farmers are carrying during these good times so that it can kind of help if it does turn the other way? Or what are you seeing overall for debt load for farmers?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator, responding, I'll take a shot at the question. I believe there has been not a significant but some reduction in overall term debt to our farmers. Having said that, there's a great deal of spending going on these days, as you well know, probably tax-motivated in some respects, but there's a great deal of cash in the country, too. So I think the debt levels are certainly – they're certainly better capitalized today than they were in the 80s. Unfortunately, I was around in the 80s, and the capital structure is much better today than it was. I mentioned the $8,000 an acre land. We did have a sale in Rock County of $8,000 per acre on a piece of farmland. But of that $8,000 an acre, I believe only a couple thousand dollars an acre was actually financed. The rest was cash, which speaks volumes about where they sit today. And as I said, their working capital structures are much better. They're much better positioned today than they were then to weather potential storms in the future.
Senator Kubley, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did, Mr.
Did you have a follow-up?
No, I was just going to comment that I'm glad to hear that because, you know, that was part of the issues in the 80s, and if we can kind of all keep that in our mind as we are going through these nice prices for beans, et cetera, that, you know, they probably aren't going to be there forever, and we have to prepare for those years also. But thank you.
Thanks. Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd just like to say thanks for supporting economic development in rural areas. I think the banks in our smaller communities are the main source of funding for that economic activity, and it does create jobs for the rural parts of the state. Just two quick questions, I guess. I'm wondering if Mr. Daggett knows of Roxanne Daggett, former member of the Minnesota House.
I'm familiar with her, yes. She encouraged me to make my bed when I was growing up. She's my mother.
I said, oh,
great.
Okay.
Well, that explains.
Well, very good. And I guess I've wondered several times, but I never think to ask the question, you know, what level of capitalization do you stop referring to a bank as a small cap bank?
Well, there's several different thresholds. There's capital ratios, which Tess talked about previously, or well capitalized is the highest designation you can give. But I think you're talking about maybe size wise, and I think generally there's several different thresholds. You hear a lot of times where they talk about maybe asset size threshold. There's some legislation that came on nationally where they used a $10 billion threshold. There's other CRA or examining ones that come at the $500 million threshold, but generally it's based on the asset side. Generally, capital is at about 8 to 10% of the asset level.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. I did want to make one announcement. I was not here Thursday. I was flying with the governor to Jackson, Minnesota, where it was announced that the company there manufactures Cat Challenger tractors. The big ones now are going to be manufactured right here in Minnesota. They're closing the plant down in France and starting out with about 125 jobs there at the Jackson campus. There's currently about 900 jobs there now. They're hoping to add another 400 additionally to that. So that's good news, good positive news for rural development here in Minnesota and for our area. And I also wanted to report there. I saw former Senator and Ag Chairman Vickerman there, and he wanted me to tell everyone hello for him. So, all right, nothing else to come before the committee. The Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies will be adjourned. Thank you.